Transportation will probably be at the end.
At the end.
Probably. Well, it might.
Get done at 10.
Yeah. And revenue will come to order. Just to let you give you, committee will come to order. Just to let you know what we're doing on the agenda, we're going to quickly run through our work sessions. Then we plan to go to the House Bill 3333. I understand we have a member of the public who's visiting us on Skype. I want to make sure that he's aware that everything he says can be heard here. Everything that happens where you are that picks up on your microphone can be heard here. So just be aware of that. So let's begin with, Paul, are we ready on 3261? We're not ready. Okay.
Amendment distributed.
All right. So we'll distribute the amendment on 3261, but we're not going to do any work on the bill today. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2541, the inheritance tax bill. Co-Chair Berger and I have been working with Legislative Revenue Office, and we're continuing to work on the issues having to do with getting this bill to revenue neutrality. So we're not ready to actually move the bill today. Do you have some comments you'd like to make?
No, simply that, committee members, we sent out when we set the Law Commission on this enormous task, revenue neutrality was one of the things that we asked for. But, of course, numbers change over time in terms of the situationally things change, and we've asked staff to go back and renorm some of the tables in there, and that takes a little more time. So we are getting ready to finish on this. Thank you.
All right. Anything else on House Bill 2541? Paul, do you want to carry it over or will we reset? We'll reset it. All right. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2541. Are we ready on 2543? We're ready? Okay. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2543.
Yeah, that's the one that has the information. Senior deferral.
Yeah.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, the House Bill 2543, we've whittled our list down to hopefully a final list for the drafting of an amendment. And so there are a number of things that have been added. The technical adjustments that were recommended by the Department of Revenue, you'll see, have been added to sections 11 through 20. And there are a number of things here that have positive revenue impacts but are not known. And those that have the revenue impacts that are known have been estimated. And there's a table in the back simulating the cash flow from implementing three of the changes. But there are other ones that we can't necessarily have the information to estimate revenue impacts on, and we'll have another positive impact. So you'll see that doesn't bring the program balance above zero, just with the changes that are seen on the back of the sheet. But the hopefully the other changes, such as the asset tests or the income test, would bring that about.
All any questions on this piece today? We had quite a conversation about it just a short while ago.
Yes, again, committee members, this is, we need to go to draft on this. So these are the things that will be going into a draft. They're not set in stone, but these are the issues that we discussed. We are going to, and then some new ones that were added by the Department of Revenue that have more to do with the administration of the program, I think. And so we will have another bite at this apple, maybe one or two.
So if you have thoughts about the material contained in the memo for today, or other ideas or material that you need to clarify with staff, or get back to the chairs and do it very quickly because we've got to get moving on this one.
And as I said, this is a draft. You'll get other bites. If there's one particular thing in there that you want a different number in, let us know.
All right. Anything else on 2543? If not, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2543 and open a work session on Senate Bill 302. Is that yours, too? Yeah. Go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Senate Bill 302 would change the repayment schedule for individuals who have a roll correction that is applied for multiple years. This would extend this opportunity to people who had the roll correction made in a window of time between May 27, 2008 and May 27, 2010. This amended repayment schedule had previously already been applied to people with roll corrections after May 27, 2010. So this just extends that to this other two-year window.
Okay. Committee, what's your pleasure? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 302 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 302 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. Representative Bailey is excused. Who would like to carry SB 302?
I'll carry it, Mr. Speaker, unless Representative Berger would like to put it on the consent calendar.
thank you for asking, Representative Gelser.
You have a different...
Feel free.
Yeah.
I explained roll corrections to the body in my last speech on this issue. I'm sure they understand it clearly.
Representative Gelser will carry. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 302 and open a public hearing. I've lost my agenda already. That doesn't work very well. On House Bill 3333. And we have some members on that bill. Yes? Why don't the members come forward and anyone you want to... Oh, yes. And the member of the lower chamber is here as well.
Mr. Chair, you got to beat up somebody. So
that's
the lower chair
has
got to come over, too.
Thank you. You gentlemen do understand why I say that. When the fire occurred in the governor's office in the middle of the building, the water flowed downhill from there toward the Senate chamber. Mazin.
Chair Bernhardt, members of the committee, House Bill 3333 basically directs the Investment Council, this is the Oregon Investment Council, and the State Treasurer to ensure that the investment funds that they're under their control and where they invested, that they will not be invested in a company doing business with Iran. This is the Islamic Republic of Iran.
All right. Well, we have an August panel. Please, whatever order you'd like to go in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for time, consideration, and support for House Bill 3333. I'm State Representative Jim Widener, House District 24, most of Yamhill County and some of Polk County, and I'm proud to have my senator sitting here beside me. Members of the House Committee on Revenue, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this morning to further explain the importance and intent behind House Bill 3333. This bill is a combined effort from a variety of organizations and has a bipartisan support. We have some great testimonies lined up, So I will just highlight some of the points that you will hear about this morning and offer my opinion on House Bill 3333. House Bill 3333 would work to divest Oregon public employee retirement funds from companies that invest in the Iranian energy sector. As of September 2009, OPERF funds have invested $250 million in companies involved with nine different Iranian oil companies. Since 2008, these stocks have performed poorly due to Iran's continued move towards nuclear technology and threat of weaponry. Not only should OIC divest because of
Excuse me just a moment, Representative. We've just been handed what is characterized as the Dash 1 amendments. Is that something you're familiar with?
Yes, the Dash 1s, they're not quite as tight. I was trying to divest from everything. The Dash 1s actually focus on the energy sector. So,
I see. So you're speaking...
I'm speaking on the Dash 1s.
You are. Okay. Thank you. As long as that's clear.
Thank you.
Right. Please go ahead.
So that comes with work with the different organizations, the Treasurer's Office, putting everything together. So everything we'll be addressing today will be the Dash 1s because that's been a collaborative effort to bring the Dash 1s together. So
thank you. That's very helpful.
So... When I was in attendance at the AIPAC dinner in Portland earlier this year, I listened to Congressman Peter DeFazio as a guest speaker. He passionately spoke of his support of H.R. 2194, the Federal Comprehensive Iranian Sanctions Accountability and Divestment Act, which Congressman DeFazio was a co-sponsor of and became law in July of 2010. He remarked about Oregon's forward-thinking tradition, humanitarian perspective, and how he was in complete support of Oregon quickly divesting from companies that do business in Iran. Just earlier this month, a secret nuclear facility was disclosed by another government dissident because the IAEA has been unable to fully investigate into the totality of the nuclear program in Iran. This bill is all the more urgent. Colleagues, I have passionately pursued this moment because the Iranian government has engaged in brazen and vulgar anti-Semitism, continued belligerent warmongering rhetoric by Ahmadinejad, and has known connections with Hamas and Hezbollah, who are responsible for the deaths of many Americans and even Oregonians serving overseas. Let's proceed alongside with President Obama, the 111th Assembly of the U.S. Congress, and 21 other states, and quickly divest from Iran. And colleagues, this bill even becomes more important to me because I have a son who's serving in the armed services as well, who spent time actually in Iraq. And if you look up June 9th, 2007, Camp Buka, you'll see where soldiers were coming from Iran into Iraq and lobbing mortars into a prison there. We lost U.S. soldiers in that prison. We lost a lot of prisoners that were in that prison that had came from other prisons, and it was one of the main sites. And it's something that will mark my son's life forever. And all of this was done with the funds and coming from Iran, where most of these soldiers were coming from. They were running back to Iran for cover. So this is a very personal issue for me as well, and every other parent who has a son in the military that has served in Iraq or overseas. So after my son's done three tours, suffers from some PTSD, this hits me very, very closely. I've had the opportunity to meet with the mayor of Itamar and his wife, and listen to their struggles and what they go through with the terrorist organizations over there. And I feel their pain. And it's something that we don't really know and fully understand here in the United States. So I encourage you to look at this very, very seriously and not think of it just as an investment, but something that we're aiding in some of the terrorist activities, because when the money flows to Iran and Iran is making profits off of our investments, they're using that money to fund terrorism, and we need to be one of the leaders in this. There's 22 other states. Let's be the 23rd and start setting a precedence for the rest of the United States to start pulling any funds that are invested in Iran. With that, I will turn it over to the senator.
I think I'm going to pass to the House since I'm the lower chamber. I'll go last, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Representative Wally Hicks from Josephine County. I come here in support of House Bill 3333 for a number of reasons. The Iranian regime maintains diplomatic relations with every nation except for the United States and Israel. The regime has committed numerous human rights violations on its own populations and has long maintained ties to terrorist organizations, violating the human rights of persons around the world. The Iranian regime has many times stated its devotion to developing self-sustaining nuclear capacity, which it intends to turn into a weapons program. The Iranian regime has interfered in the Iraqi war and the insurgents that have been fighting against the U.S. troops there and killing U.S. troops. In fact, on 25 December 2006, United States Armed Forces arrested four senior Iranian military officials in Baghdad on suspicion of aiding the insurgency. The British Sunday Times reported in September 5, 2010, that Iranian businesses are paying Taliban fighters $1,000 for each U.S. soldier they kill in Afghanistan and $6,000 for destruction of each U.S. vehicle. Iran's weapon programs, not just nuclear, but on down the line regarding military equipment, are self-sustaining within Iran. The UN embargo has prohibited most sales of weaponry to Iran, so the money that they make through their business enterprises goes directly into their weapons program. I come here as one of the two veterans of the Iraq War currently serving in the Oregon legislature, Senator Boquist, and I are here together, who is the other veteran of the Iraq War, and I do want to impress the significance of that on the committee and my support of this bill for the reasons previously stated. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, distinguished members of the committee, I'm Senator Brian Boquist, 12th Senate District. It's five rural counties in the valley here, along with six voters in Lane County, and I'm also the chairman of the Veterans and Military Affairs Committee. Colleagues, I was involved in the 0507 Sudan divestiture bill that came out of both chambers. Several of you voted for that when it was passed. The argument back then was the state has a fiduciary responsibility we should not get involved in, and the second argument that was out there is it won't do any good. The fact of the matter is, from the fiduciary point of view, we haven't suffered any losses, as we did not suffer any losses during the apartheid issues that came through the legislature. And the next thing that comes out, the result in Sudan was actually a democratic election, and so far it is holding. So peace came about by the efforts of the states and the federal government combined. I would point out in the Iranian situation that we're facing right now, I actually carried a bill across one of the chambers to the second chamber, and we didn't get it passed. This bill is actually a much more permissive bill. It does have a latitude that gives more fiduciary responsibility options to the Treasurer and the Oregon Investment Council. Having said that, though, you're going to see testimony a little bit later in here that shows that of the top six invested companies we are in, they lost somewhere between 56% and 10% of their value. So if you happen to look at the news and you follow your stocks or your retirement accounts, you'll see every time something goes bad, the stock goes down. So there are those that have argued for multiple sessions the fiduciary responsibility is to pack up and get out because we're losing money. The other thing that's very interesting that you will see in testimony around here, which I intend once the Mad Week gets done this week and next week, is to go back and reread my Sudan report that you all received a copy of it, because about a third of the companies that are on our present investment list in Iran are on the Sudanese list where we're not supposed to be invested. And that is a much more, much tighter bill that we passed out of this chamber. Like Representative Hicks here, I have actually been boots on the ground on both sides of Iran. I was boots on the ground in Sudan, and I had the distinguished pleasure to have mortar rounds dropped on top of me. So therefore, I'm quite attuned to the fact that 2 weeks ago, a whole series of mortar equipment, mortar rounds were captured again in Afghanistan that were being fired upon our troops. And when I say our troops, let us keep in mind that 13,000 members of the Oregon Army National Guard and Air Guard have been deployed in both of these places. So it is our fight. It is our responsibility. I hope this time, because I'll be blunt, it was that there's a companion bill just like this on our chamber that was killed, and I would hope that this one comes across the chamber, because there are bipartisan sponsors on our side, and if we get it in the right committee, we will work with the House and work with the Treasurer's Office to push forward in this. But if you watch the 6 o'clock news, or CNN, or Fox News, or whatever you happen to watch, this is an issue that comes up every night. And I would appreciate your action, very supportive of both of the representatives, and be delighted to take questions. And I'm always open to spar with the Treasurer's Office.
Or anybody else.
Thank you. And with that, we'll take questions. Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. You mentioned, Senator Boquist, about the Sudanese divestiture that went through a few years ago and that we're currently still invested in that. Is that through direct holdings or through funds where outside money managers are doing it? How is that happening? That's a bit troubling if you believe we're out of compliance.
Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, Vice Chair Brewer. What we have is there's a whole combination of those. And in the Sudan divestiture, one of the problems you have in these floating, as you said, different market areas and different places that we invest in different funds is they buy and trade all the time. And so to the defense of the treasurer, what you have to do is you kind of have to keep track of these because many times they're 2, 3, or 4 tiers down. There are agreements and then somebody makes a trade and suddenly we end up with a small portion of our portfolio in these companies. And then we have to kind of identify it, and then we have to work backwards to come back out of it. Luckily so, it's a smaller amount than it ever has been in the past. But, I mean, the leading individual or the leading companies that we have problem with are, of course, the Chinese. Now, that shouldn't surprise anybody, but that's really the issue right there. And, again, the Treasurer's Office and the Oregon Investment Council have been very responsive to that. It's when you identify it, you see it, and then you come back because, again, you're talking about, as you know, portfolios that are billions and tens of billions of dollars, and then magically you find out we're back there, and they didn't even know because what we tried to do in the Sudan divestiture bill and is in this particular bill and it was in his companion's bill is not to hold the Treasurer to a standard that you must absolutely ironclad do this because you don't know in these trades what's going on. And it many times with lots of other areas in state government, some citizen notices this is, hey, you know, we're doing this and we're back there, and then we identify it. Then we take it back in cases, this case, the Oregon Investment Council and the Treasurer. And then they look into it, and then they go back to the fund manager and say, hey, we're not supposed to be in there, and then we correct it. This is an ongoing. It's like any other government agency. You've got to keep a very watchful eye on it.
One follow-up comment. Thank you for clarifying. I suspected that was it. It was more in the fund managers and trying to keep those funds pure, which is always a challenge. And I want to thank you both for your service and for your son's service as well.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. I think you've staged the bill well. Appreciate it. Very.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Co-chairs.
Bob Morgenstein, Ken, I'm going to butcher this one, Wartler, perhaps?
Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee, my name is Bob Horenstein. I'm the Community Relations and Allocations Director for the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. And first of all, thank you for this opportunity. We feel this is a very important bill. I just want to explain briefly, the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland Community Relations Committee is a body that reflects a cross-section of the organized Jewish community. In other words, we represent the mainstream positions on a whole number of public affairs issues. Our committee is made up of members that are progressive, centrist, conservative, everything from humanist to orthodox and everything in between. So we are here speaking on behalf of the organized Jewish community. We ask your support of House Bill 3333. We believe that there are important financial, political, and moral reasons why we should become the 23rd state of the United States to support divestment from energy companies that are investing substantially in Iran's oil and gas sectors. And I'd like to turn it over to one of our executive committee members, Ken Kortler, to continue the discussion.
Thank you. Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, distinguished members of the committee, thank you very much for your time and attention this morning. I'd also like to thank Senator Boquist and Representatives Widener and Hicks for their excellent comments. I'm not sure that I can exceed their eloquence in addressing this matter. I'd also like to thank Representative Hicks and Senator Boquist and Representative Widener's son for their courage and bravery in defending our nation. As they pointed out...
And for the record, would you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, that would be a good idea, too. I'm Ken Kortler. I'm an intellectual property attorney in Lake Oswego, Oregon, and I'm a member of the Executive Committee of the Community Relations Council of the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Iran is the leading state sponsor of terrorism internationally. Iran is seeking rapidly to develop nuclear weapons and advanced delivery systems for those weapons. Iran is a horrific human rights abuser and is supporting terrorist groups worldwide that are pursuing genocide. But believe it or not, I can actually give you two better reasons than that why this bill ought to pass. The first of which is that Iran has funded, armed, and trained insurgents in Iraq and in Afghanistan who have killed American service people, particularly our fellow Oregonians in the service of our nation. And secondly, and on a far lower level, because it makes tremendous economic sense, as I'll discuss in just a second. I had the privilege in 2008 of hearing then-Senator Obama speak during his campaign and say that a nuclear Iran would be an absolute game-changer and that he would do everything in his power as president to prevent it. We all remember the president's speech from Cairo shortly after he took office, in which he addressed the Iranian regime and said, "We offer you an outstretched hand. If you would kindly unclench your fist, we are happy to engage with you." Unfortunately, more than 2 years into the administration, I think the administration itself has recognized that this approach has yet to be fruitful. And last July, President Obama signed into law the Comprehensive Iran Sanctions Accountability and Divestment Act, CISADA for short. CISADA was a measure that had extraordinary bipartisan support. It passed the United States Senate 99-0. It passed the United States House of Representatives 408-8. Among its other provisions regarding sanctions, it encourages states such as Oregon to divest their pension funds from investments in the Iranian energy sector and other areas of the Iranian economy. Just this Monday, there was an article in the Washington Post, sorry I neglected to bring it for you, talking about how the regime's stability in Iran is being increasingly called into question because of the rise in things like home heating oil throughout the Iranian economy. As we mentioned earlier, there are 23 other states that have enacted measures like this. I believe 18 or 19 have done it legislatively. Others have done it through the equivalents of the Oregon Investment Council. It is extremely important that we follow the lead that the federal government has set here and pursue this legislation. Now, the second reason I've got for you is these have been terrible investments. I have handed out, not enough copies, I'm sorry. I have two more there, I'm sorry. This chart shows the performance of the 9 stocks that are sanctionable, that are companies that are active in the Iranian energy sector. We got the list from a Freedom of Information Act request we gave to the Treasurer's Office. The list was current as of October 23rd, 2009. And what I've done is track... I show the 9 companies themselves, the amount of money that OPERF has in them. The collective total is $253 million of Oregon retirement funds. The stock price, going back, frankly, as far as the MarketWatch website would let me go back at that point in time to May of 2008, and the stock price as it closed yesterday. And you can see in the change in value column how miserably most of these stocks have performed. Down 13%, 31%, 40%, 56.9%. Now, you might well say these haven't been 3 terrific years for the world economy, and you'd be absolutely right. But by comparison, the chart below offers the performance of 5 other leading energy companies that are not active in the Iranian energy sector, as well as the performance of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which take as sort of a broader statement. And you can see how much more satisfactorily these investments have performed than the investments in Iran. And it's hardly a surprise when you're dealing with a belligerent country that is increasingly facing involved in military conflicts around the world, provoking military conflicts, incurring sanctions from the United States and Europe. It's no surprise at all to see that companies like this simply make a poor investment. I would even argue that in the past we've had folks say, we have to put politics aside here. We're acting strictly on a financial basis. We have to act for the benefit of the fund holders. I would argue that the OIC is potentially breaching its fiduciary duty to those fund holders by leaving the money in these investments at the same moment that it's insisting it would breach those obligations by removing them. And so I would encourage this committee to act on the bill and to move it forward. And I thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel?
May I add just a
couple
additional remarks? It's hard to add to Ken's eloquent testimony. First of all, I just want to be understood that the companies that we're interested in, that we're focusing on, these energy companies, and there may be others, by the way. This is just a good sampling of those energy companies that we know the Oregon Investment Council has been investing in. These are companies that, under federal law, are liable to a menu of sanctions. And the trend has been to ratchet up the sanctions, as you know. So, in other words, if the administration decides at any moment to impose sanctions on these foreign energy companies, not only are they performing not so well currently, but presumably if sanctions are imposed, their stock value will plummet. So they are a poor and risky investment in that sense as well. I also want to mention that we are trying to work very closely with the treasurer in order to come up with the appropriate language that can be acceptable so that we can move to a point where we achieve the ultimate goal, which is to engage these companies and to say to them, if you aren't willing to pull out of Iran, which we all understand is a bad character, it's a pariah state, then we believe we shouldn't be investing our dollars in those companies. And just for the record, I happen to be a PERS member myself, and also my wife's family, on an additional personal note, my wife's family did flee Iran. So this is also a very important personal matter to me as well. So thank you, Co-chairs Barnhart and Berger and members of this committee, and we hope that you will support this bill and we can get it through the House and on to the Senate. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Let's hear from Eric Liebman, who's joined us via Skype. Eric, can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
We can. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Eric Liebman, and I live in Hillsdale neighborhood of Portland. Married two kids, lived in Portland for 7 years, member of the organized Jewish community. And the people who have gone before me have done such a remarkably fine job of outlining the issues and the personal connections. I'll be brief, and I'm not going to go on for very long because I want you to be able to just focus and concentrate on what they've said so well. I just want to speak for a moment on the very personal connections for me and my family in this matter. I have five nephews and nieces who live in Jerusalem. I also have members of my synagogue whose sons will be studying in a religious school in Jerusalem next year. And it's very common to have a fair amount of traffic going back and forth from Portland's Jewish community and non-Jewish community to Israel to study and live there. So we have a lot personally at risk here. And for a bad actor like Iran's president at the helm of a nuclear weapon, obviously extremely concerned about how this impacts the safety of the people who are very close to me. As indeed many members of the Orphan's Jewish community and some non-Jewish members, there's another personal aspect to this.
I'm afraid you're breaking up.
Okay, it's okay on my end. Do you want to try to check that out for a second, or should I keep talking?
Well, go ahead. We lost the last sentence or two.
Sure. With a bad actor like Iran, of course, we're tremendously concerned in our religious community, and indeed in the non-Jewish religious community as well. Citizens all over, but it impacts close to home. What would happen if someone apparently unstable is the president of Iran got a hold of a nuclear bomb. I got family. I got a lot of family in Israel. A lot of us in this community do. The other personal connection I have to this issue is that I've been fairly close to a number of members of the armed services who have served over the years in Iraq and Afghanistan, most notably Sergeant Rico Collazo, who is a friend of mine, made his acquaintance when I started writing to members of the armed services over there as part of a pen pal organization. And he's done three tours in Iraq. He's in Afghanistan now as a forward artillery observer. And, you know, a nuclear-armed Iran is going to make it infinitely more dangerous and more complicated for our forces to operate over there and for us to pursue our own regional and strategic goals.
And Michael.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up again.
Okay, and that's, that's the most important thing I wanted to talk about.
And we appreciate your testimony. Are there any questions for Eric? Thank you, sir. We very much appreciate your joining us this way today. For me, it's somewhat of an experiment, and I think it worked fine. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
David Magara.
Good morning. I want to thank each of you for the opportunity to be here today and speak on behalf of House Bill 3333. My name is Dave Magira. I live in Polk County. I have the privilege of pastoring here in Salem at the First Church of the Nazarene. And I'm here to urge your support of this bill. Oregon has the opportunity to pass a bill which will ensure that the public funds are not invested unwisely in companies that do business with Iran, which, as you've already heard and been reminded of today, it's the number one terror-supporting state. My appeal is one that's really based on a good moral decision, as well as carrying out fiduciary responsibilities. As you know, other states have already acted on this, and others are in the process as well. And the call is to keep the state from funds from being invested in international companies that have already been identified as doing business with Iran. Back in 2009, I sat on the other side of the wall at a Senate hearing when this bill came before the Senate. And there seemed to be a couple of hurdles that would stand in the way of the bill, those being the cost of administrating and overseeing the investments, and then they added two attorney general opinions and two court proceedings in Oregon. But these potential technicalities are what separates citizens like me from elected leaders like you, who have the position and the power to face the hurdles and find a way to make sure that Oregon is aligned with the standing of the federal government's issue and stand on Iran sanctions. I won't take the time to go into detail on all the great reasons to pass the bill, but I would appeal to you to be extremely informed about this issue. We've got to find every way possible to keep Iran's feet held to the fire. It was just over 2 years ago, and 1 week, that we watched the launch of the rocket by North Korea that became a perfect example of why we need to rise to the occasion here. The world made numerous appeals to North Korea saying, don't do this, don't do this, don't launch that rocket. And after it was launched, the world said, you shouldn't have done that, you shouldn't have done that. Representatives, I believe with all my heart that this will be the response of the world towards Iran after the fact. During that proceeding and what was going on, there was a leader in Iran who watched the world's response, who watched very carefully the aftermath, because there wasn't any. And after they have launched a nuclear missile, more than likely in Israel, the world will say, well, you shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have done that. I'm appealing to you this morning to be proactive in our state's dealings with Iran. We can do something to make a difference, and this would be a tremendous step for our state morally and ethically, not to mention it's just good sense with our investments. None of us would be thinking of investing in a company that had heavy sanctions coming down on it, and neither should Oregon. I sincerely thank you for your openness in letting us make an appeal for this bill. For me personally, I have family members serving in Afghanistan, as well as young men and women in my congregation who are serving. And I urge you to find a way to pass this bill, even if it means refining it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony. Michael Salvaggio from the Treasurer's Office. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer, and I'll keep my remarks brief and then pause for questions. The Treasurer's Office supports House Bill 3333. We feel that it's a strong support and statement of legislative intent and support for the Treasury's efforts with the Jewish Federation to develop OIC policy that will create guidelines and instructions for the Investment Council to properly evaluate the associated risks associated with investment in Iran. We do acknowledge that there's political, social, and legal circumstances surrounding those investments, and they can potentially create risks for our investments. And those efforts to evaluate those are ongoing. We're working with the Jewish Federation as well as other stakeholders to craft that policy. And I do expect that we will come to a point where we will be recommending such a policy at an OIC meeting in the very near future. So I think that House Bill 3333 adds to that effort, adds a legislative voice to that policy, and we urge your support and passage.
Thank you. And are you referring to the Dash Ones or the original bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I only became aware of the Dash One amendments this morning. I still don't have a copy of those, so I can't speak to those.
Thank you. So you're referring to the original bill?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Yes, Representative Berger.
Yes, Michael, our primary responsibility here is fiduciary over the funds that you are investing in. That is the Treasurer's constitutional responsibility. So I want to be really clear what you're saying is that you don't believe any of the language in the original, and I think the Dash 1 is even a more narrow look at this, in any way interfere with that constitutional fiduciary responsibility.
Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee, the short answer is that is correct. We feel that the current bill does not contain any legislative mandate to take a particular course of action, as Senator Boquist suggested, and that is that I concur with his suggestion. And the instructions will be to the Oregon Investment Council, which we feel is the proper body that should evaluate those risks, evaluate those investments, and then act accordingly. That's the body that the state has set up to perform that function, and we feel that that's where the final decision should reside. But this bill does provide a statement of intent so as to say, please evaluate these risks. This is something the legislature cares about.
Yes, please.
Then just one follow-through. I hope that the Treasurer will take a... I like the Dash Ones because it is more narrowly focused on this particular energy sector piece, and I would hope that you will scrutinize it equally and alert us if any other conclusion is reached, because this is an important thing to me, and I think to this body.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, we absolutely will. We have very, very fine tooth combs at Treasury.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Do you have a sense today of what level of exposure we have to companies that are invested in Iran now?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, the data that was presented by the Jewish Federation is correct as of 2009, but as was discussed, these investments oftentimes they move under our feet. So it would be quite a task to continuously monitor to give you a day to day. But if you want a snapshot at any point in time, we can certainly pull that information together for you.
Well, what I'm really trying to get at is sort of an order of magnitude kind of estimate. I'm guessing that companies that invested in Iran are not the major part of our portfolio. but they're not de minimis either. But I don't know that. Can you give us a thought about that?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I would imagine that that's accurate. And again, I don't want to speak without having up-to-date data in front of me. But essentially, we're looking at, I think, 9 companies that would be under scrutiny here. Like I said, whether or not sand has moved under our feet or not, I can't say for sure. None of those companies are Iranian companies or associated with the government of Iran. What you'll see is, for instance, Royal Dutch Shell, as of 2009, $115 million invested. That's not entirely within the nation of Iran. Obviously, that's a portion of their business. I couldn't tell you straight up what portion of that $115 million is working in Iran.
You know, I asked the question, I hadn't actually looked at the second column. That's very helpful.
Yeah.
And of course, you're right. Royal Dutch investments all over the world. Yeah. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate the Treasurer's perspective on a bill of this kind.
Thank you.
Tricia Smith, Mary Botkin. And is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill this morning? Okay. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith, and I represent Oregon School Employees Association, 21,000 education professionals working from Head Start through K-12 into community colleges all over Oregon. And I am here today. I really can't tell you if we have a position on this bill at this point. First thing I want to say is, for me, the benefit of public hearings of these issues was brought home to me today on this bill. We are one of the founding members of the PERS Coalition, and we have seen many, many bills like this in the past. And we generally have some concern about them because of the fiduciary responsibility to the fund and to the members who own the fund and how that coincides with that legislation. Some bills have been written so that we felt that those obligations were put in jeopardy and we wouldn't support them. We are not here to say anything other than we agree with everything people have said about the state of Iran and its havoc on the world. We are also very, very pleased that Senator Boqvist spoke so eloquently and clearly about the intention of this bill. We appreciate very much the sponsors writing the bill so that it is consistent with existing investment policy and that it encourages the Investment Council to do these things. It doesn't mandate it. So while I came into the room with concerns for this bill, listening to the testimony has alleviated many of those concerns, and certainly Representative Berger's questions to the Treasury have made me feel even better. We have not seen the Dash 1 amendments. We have heard about them. We're interested in looking at them. And so with that, we appreciate this committee's very thoughtful consideration of this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mary Botkin, for the record, representing AFSCME Council 75. AFSCME has a long history with divestitures in countries of less than positive political means. I started my career with AFSCME with the South African divestiture and worked with members of both the House and the Senate to kind of help get that bill through. That bill had a lot of problems with the Treasury and with sort of the legal issues around divestiture. And I think that I agree with Tricia. I think that Senator Boqvist has resolved many of those concerns and those issues that we initially had. I cannot say how important to our union socially responsible investments is. Our members do not want to finance the exploitation of human beings. They do not want to finance a war machine, and they really don't want to finance a country that is raining terror upon its own people and the rest of the world. Having said that, they also want to be sure that their retirement funds are secure. And I think that it would be a good discussion for the Treasury and the Investment Council to have to talk about long-term, more socially responsible investments generally, and yet also see if there isn't a way to do that with a way that matches the needs that are required under federal law, under state law, and under the guidelines of prudent person rules. Having said that, I too share with Tricia that public testimony and public hearings are very valuable, and I now have a much better understanding of what the senator is trying to accomplish, and we support that effort full-heartedly. So,
thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Any comments in connection with the public hearing before we close it? Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3333 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2328. Maz, is that yours?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Chair Bernhardt, members of the committee, House Bill 2328 comes to you via House Transportation Committee, and the major idea about House Bill 2328 obviously have gone through several amendments. Comes to you as the A engrossed version. This A engrossed version have went through about, I guess, 8 amendments before it came to you. And as it stands today, the idea still is to create a road use charge for the plug-in and the electric vehicles. The main idea behind this issue is that the highway and the road system in Oregon is paid for through a network of taxes and fees that are constitutionally dedicated and constructed around the use of the road. And most of this now centers either on payment by the light vehicles, which the electric vehicles belong to, and most of the light vehicles pay their constitutionally responsible payments through the gas tax. Now, having the gas tax being less important for the propulsion of this type of new vehicle, basically the system of funding the highways and the roads would basically lose a major component of how it pays and collects for that system. This bill attempts to put this back into the system, or put the plug back into the hole, if you will. No pun intended. It just came out that way.
Of course, of course.
And the way it attempts to do that, basically to levy a per mile charge. The per mile charge suggested in this A version of the bill is No wonder the media gets it wrong, right? 1.43 cents per mile for each mile, and this is for the vehicles, as I mentioned, the lightweight vehicles, which is 10,000 pounds and less. It also puts few suggestions and ways on how to collect this type of charge, what kind of technology, and requires ODOT to develop that type of collection methodology without having to resort to tracking devices within the system. This all also puts starting to put the ideas of how you account for miles inside and outside state, because today with the fuel tax, you're inside and outside the state probably wash out by different payments of taxation from different states. However, that might not be the same type of situation in front of the road funding system when it comes to road users charge or for the electric hybrid vehicles or electric vehicles. The other stuff of it in the bill puts the whole mechanism back into the same highway and road funding mechanism by making distribution formulas between state and locals 50-50-50, and puts these tries to put it back into the shelves, if you will, that we have for the different funding mechanisms and distribution. And of course today this is probably one of the most creative ways of looking at new technologies and how we do. However,
thank you. Yeah, Representative Berger.
Yeah, a couple of technical questions. Primarily, is this have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
Yes. It also has a 3/5.
And it has a 3/5 vote. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Witte. Now, the bill's already been heard in Transportation Economic Development. Do either of you want to be heard on the bill? We do have a request from Representative Beyer to testify, but she's not arrived yet. So,
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity. I think Mr. Witte is very well qualified and situated to get us started, and I'd be happy to add anything that people are curious about from our perspective in the committee, but Mr. Witte will get us off to a great start.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity, and I join Representative Reed in awaiting Mr. Witte's presentation.
Thank you. Please, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, and members of the committee, my name is James Witte. I'm the manager of the Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding at the Oregon Department of Transportation. I can also speak to the Road User Fee Task Force, as I administer that body for ODOT, and that body is the original writer and proposer of the House Bill 2328 that was considered by the House Transportation Committee. House Bill 2328 established something new, a vehicle road usage charge on electric and plug-in hybrid electric motor vehicles in 2014 for the 2014 model year and beyond. The task force, Road User Fee Task Force, was addressing something that was emerging but came into focus last year in a big way with the new electric vehicles entered our roadways in 2010. This new fleet of vehicles is really the result of 10 years of research in technologies for greater fuel efficiency in vehicle energy consumption. And as we see now, these vehicles will pay little or no gas tax. Two factors drive this development. One, the public demand for fuel efficiency improved vehicles. We saw in 2008 that demand when the price of gasoline went to $4. And we're seeing it again. And whenever we see that threshold reached and go beyond, the public starts to look for alternative fuel vehicles that get good mileage. A second factor, and a very important one, is the CAFE standards, the corporate average fuel economy standards set by the United States government. They currently require dramatic improvements in the fuel efficiency of the vehicle fleet by 2016, not all that far away, for an average of 35.5 miles per gallon for the new vehicles entering the marketplace. This averages out to 42 miles per gallon for cars and 26 miles per gallon for light trucks. So we're entering an age of greatly increased fuel efficiency, and in a state that relies upon the gas tax for 60% of its revenue, state and federal, and also pegs its weight distance tax to collection of fuel tax levels. We're dependent on 80% on collection of revenues from the fuel, from the gas tax, or the fuel tax. looking at the situation from that vantage point, these new fuel-efficient vehicles should pay something for the use of the road system. The question is, what should they pay and when should they pay it? There's really basically two options, and they're being considered in the Northwest, a flat fee considered in Washington legislature right now, and a tax based on use, which is this bill, House Bill 2328. The task force and ODOT suggest that Oregon ought to stay consistent with its 92-year-old policy of taxing vehicles based on their use rather than a flat charge. Now, in designing this bill, the Road User Fee Task Force had some lessons that we've learned based on our 9-year history working in this area of a mileage-based user charge. We ran a pilot project, some of you may remember, back in 2006 and 2007 that caught the attention of the nation and actually started that dialogue at the national level. No one else has run a pilot project like we have yet. Others are working on them, however. What are the lessons? Do not mandate a GPS box for motorist cars. I learned that lesson personally and have communicated that to people so they understand that that's not the way we get to a mileage-based user fee. Secondly, provide motorist choices for how they report their mileage, leading to public acceptance. Not one system or one method may not suffice for all. Everybody will find a reason to object to a single methodology. Provide multiple methodologies, and we might get public acceptance. Allow the private sector to provide data collection and payment options. In an age where government is shrinking, or there's a great intention for government to shrink, we should provide a way for a new system to grow without having large numbers of new government employees to make the system work. The private sector can aid that movement. And then fourth, allow the vehicle technology to evolve with improvements in the technology and customer preferences under an open technology system. The Road User Fee Task Force kept these lessons in mind in designing House Bill 2328. Administrator Malik did a lot of discussion of what the bill does. I can go into greater detail if the co-chair Barnhart would like.
Let's inquire. Maybe let members ask questions. You have a very detailed statement that we received. Looks like it's about 6 or 8 pages long, which I suspect explains the bill the way you want to do it.
It does, Mr. Chair.
And we'll expect members to, we're not voting on the bill today, so we'll expect members to take a look at that. Did you have other things you wanted to say, or are you ready to?
No, I do have a few more things to say.
Before questions.
That won't go into the details.
Thanks.
A number of people that look at this question ask whether that we should engage in electronic reporting, which is what the bill mandates of the mileage data, versus manual reporting. And this discussion happens all over the nation, actually. I want to briefly go over the difference and why electronic reporting is in the bill and really more advantageous. Manual reporting, the agency would have to deal with. Manual reporting is simple for the person who has to report, simply send in a number. But it has a lot of problems when we receive it on the agency side. First of all, we have to deal with failure to report. Secondly, fraud. Third, transposition errors. Manual data entry. Somebody has to key punch it in. No audit trail whatsoever. Extensive customer interface dealing with problems and complaints, leading to more government employees and then higher administrative costs. Electronic reporting has, we have the opportunity for automatic data reporting, accurate reporting, automatic data entry, ability to audit, there's an audit trail, and therefore less need for customer interface and lower administrative costs, and therefore greater net revenues. So that's important to understand. The issue comes up, and I wanted the committee to understand that. I will just simply go to the summary then, the conclusion. Oregon will need something like a mileage charge for the future fuel-efficient vehicles. Now, this is the first entry of exciting new fuel-efficient vehicles, but you can expect more to come in the future. The gasoline and diesel engines will improve. We'll see fuel cell vehicles in the not too distant future, and they will all challenge our gas tax collection system revenues. And so this is a way to move towards that. The new collection system needs to be in place when this occurs. And it's easier to start small with a small set of vehicles, creating a small risk environment. The new electric vehicle fleet provides this opportunity. To wait makes the start complex and more expensive. It's better to start sooner with a smaller group to make the system development easier. So ODOT recommends passage of House Bill 2328.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. More of a comment, really.
Please.
If that's okay. I had the pleasure of serving on the Transportation Committee last session and had a chance to see the brick wall of perception that was run into around some of the previous iterations of this idea, and I'm really appreciative of Mr. Witte for pushing forward on this, for finding a solution that works, and because the reality is in my mind, this is the direction that we're going to have to go. And so finding a workable solution that works for the public as well as for policy has been a delicate balancing act.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What was the vote coming out of the Transportation Committee?
I think 7-1 was it?
6-2, Mr. Chair, I know the vote, if you like.
You know the vote?
Yes.
I'm sure you do.
6-2. Yeah. Evenly split among the two parties.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. There's a lot of conceptual questions, and I think I'm going to read through on the technical side of it. And perhaps because it's first blush, it's troublesome to me. It is an idea that we have to get used to in general. I'm not crazy about creating a complicated system right now when we have a very small population of this. But one of the things, I look at this when we have citizens that have to provide information to the government, personal information to the government. It may not seem all that personal, but it is actually very personal on behaviors. Does this bill, and I haven't looked at it close enough to know, does this bill talk about confidentiality of information transmitted to the government and who has access to it once it's transmitted? And I look at this couched in terms of when we give information to for Department of Revenue or Internal Revenue Service, there's a high level of confidentiality with that information. Does this bill speak to that at all?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Brewer, there is no precise confidentiality provisions in this particular bill.
If I might follow up with
that. Please, go ahead. Yeah.
Besides all the foundational concerns that I might have with this bill in general and the concept in general, that is very important to me. I would not want this information to be used against consumers for other purposes, such as insurance and other types of things. This seems to be purely for a funding mechanism, and I would like that is a very big concern of mine.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Brewer's question sparked a question in my mind.
Please, go ahead.
For Mr. Witte, and that is, given the challenges in setting up a system and walking that fine line of voluntary reporting versus odometer-based systems versus electronic, How quickly do you think you can get a system like this up and running, and is there a tension between getting something in the door now and sort of making sure that the system's right when it does roll out?
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Bailey, the 2014 start date is a rather soon, it's less than 3 years away. We know that we can have an odometer reading now for by simply using the what's known as the onboard diagnostic port in the car. That'll get an odometer reading. That system's already available. The vision we want to reach for, however, is to have a wireless reporting from the odometer. That may be accomplished by the 2014 date. It certainly is a very simple method, but it may take longer because while the technology exists, we know what it is, it hasn't been applied yet here. So we would have to run, it's really the testing portion that takes, we have to have a sufficient testing period to make sure that it works before you deploy it. And so I'd want to shoot for that date, the 2014 start date, but I can't be assured that we would meet that. That would make it very simple for everyone. Nobody would have to write a number down. Nobody would have to do anything except for their mileage reading would simply arrive at the computer, and they would get a bill in the mail. That would be the simplest for anybody.
Please. Mr. Kutcher, on a different line?
Yep, go ahead.
Thank you. This may actually be a question for Mazen. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the cost responsibility model and the efficient fee method that we've heard about around the highway cost allocation study here in the committee and how that might apply to determining the rate if this moves forward.
Sure. Senator Bailey, unfortunately, with all the discussion about it, you almost have a constitutional mandate to produce a type of payment for this type of vehicles. The Constitution requires that the revenue committees and the transportation committees find a way for all the vehicles to pay their equal share and so on, and to actually enact legislation to do so. So it's almost... It's not gonna go away until that constitutional requirement somehow is satisfied. So that's why the highway cost allocation produces all this work to do it. And the highway cost allocation looks at what types of payments for different types of vehicles and different classes and so on, and also what all the subsidies at and how do you pay for the subsidies in case you choose to subsidize any of this. And then we develop a model for all these types, and we do have this computerized model that we run the rates at, and we're looking at this time to produce the cost responsible model rate, if you will, for the this type of vehicles. At this time, it looks like it is about somewhere in the 150 or so, a little more than that, to get there. Then you have, luckily, we've produced in the last session, or out of House Bill 2001, there was a requirement to go with the efficient fee methodology. And what the efficient fee methodology is basically attempted to do, and it was presented to you a while ago, is that if you have to charge all these vehicles a fee that is based on their use and complete different instruments from where you would have the gas tax or the weight mile, and just charge them on things like congestion fee, payment fee, the bridge fee, common charge, and emission fee, what would that fee would be? And this is an interesting way to do it, and it's completely as if that you're charging, and the fee is charging and changing according to the time and use and how much you do with that. And also by using this efficient, we know that the average efficient fee is per mile. We have a cost per mile of average efficient fee at 2.93 cents per mile. Now, that, keep in mind, includes the average emission fee, too. Now, these vehicles would not produce as much emissions as the regular vehicles would, which means you could give them that credit back in allowing that the adjustments for the rates. So in doing that, we will be able to come almost extremely close to how much that type of vehicles would come to cost and how much it needs to be charged to satisfy the constitutional requirement of tagging the right fee to the right vehicle. Is that responsive?
Representative Berger.
So, of course, Mazin, I have to ask, if you take out the emissions piece, what do you come up with?
I think we come up close. This is what we're starting to to get. Now, remember, the efficient fee does not assume that you do registration fees, because it assumes that, you know, everything is based on an efficient fee, and the efficient fee almost adjusts according to what you do. But the fact of life is we do have registration fees, and we have title fees, this part of OTA 1, 2, and 3, and the 2001, and so on. So once you start figuring those out, and how much those are paying actually per mile, and peeling off $1.09 or 1 point, here I go again, 1.09 cents, not $1.09, 1.09 cents per mile for the emission fee. That's a total emission fee. We would like to figure out also there is certain emissions with the batteries and disposable and the production of electricity and so on. So it's not going to peel off all of that. Once you do that, I think we're within the parameters of about 1.55 and 1.6. So we're trying to fine tune that that fee at this point by running the models.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Just curious, Mr. Wood, if you have any comment on that methodology and how that relates to your work.
I do not. Yes, Representative Reed, and then Representative Brewer.
Just to respond to that question or that comment from Mazin, I think, and my co-chair can correct me, I think the work that we did in the Transportation Economic Development Committee was focused more on the structure and so on and not the methodology. So at least for me, I'm perfectly comfortable accommodating that more specific analysis and calculation. Our work, at least in my view, was more focused on the policy and not the number.
I think that is the case. Yeah. Well, and of course, this committee is responsible for the constitutional
right.
application of the law, and so we are going to have to get to the number.
Absolutely.
And the methodology, which is partly established in case law and partly established in logic, I think helps us with that.
Indeed.
Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have three questions or refinements maybe. One of the enactment back in Section 34, it talks about ODOT coming back and talking about the likelihood that the department could implement the vehicle road uses charge before January 1st, 2014. Section 33 talks about it first applies to the 2014 model year motor vehicles. I was wondering if maybe the committee or Mr. Witte could discuss what we mean by 34 about why do we care about the likelihood of it being implemented before January 1st, 2014.
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members, Representative Brewer, this amendment was actually put forward by Senator Starr. He came to the committee and supported the bill but had some amendments. And he was interested in having the system start as soon as possible. So that's what this section really relates to, is to inform the legislative assembly before the next session, which would be in 2013.
We have to meet February of next year in our next regular session.
Well, this section would inform the 2013 Legislative
okay.
Assembly whether they could start the system sooner than 2014.
Thank you.
That's all.
And we've been joined by Representative Beyer.
Thank you, but if you still have questions,
Thank you. If I have two other questions. One is about the reporting and penalties. It appears that this this bill is requiring monthly reporting of mileage and paying of mileage, which is a frequent, you know, under Section 8, it talks about it. Page 4 on lines 2 and 3, it talks about it being monthly reporting and paying. And then we get down to Section 9, which talks about penalties for delinquency and paying it. Starts off with $25 for the first time that you're delinquent in payment, and then $50 for each for the second and future delinquencies. And I don't see a cap or a maximum penalty for late payment. Was that discussed, or can you address that, or did I miss a cap?
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members, Representative Brewer, the cap was not discussed. If we want to go into detail into this, I would prefer to have Maureen Bach up here from the Fuels Tax Group, who deals with enforcement issues. I would like to discuss, Mr. Chair, however, the monthly reporting, because I think in most cases that monthly reporting would not be the case. The bill gives the department authority to collect less frequently than monthly, and it does not behoove the department to collect a small fee regularly. It simply does not. It increases cost of collection, and so I think you can see the department, if the fee is going to be in the under $20, wanting to group to aggregate the fees and collect them on a more or less frequent basis.
Mm-hmm. Sort of like we do payroll taxes. Small businesses pay less frequently than big businesses do.
But this is an important issue. The bill was drafted to be comparable to what we have now with the weight distance tax. The Oregon Department of Transportation is given a lot of authority to structure that collection of that tax and collection of the data to fit various vehicle classes. And so that's why the bill has this flexibility in it. And I could see if it's a method that somebody selects that's fairly cumbersome, say going and getting your onboard diagnostic port read, that probably it would be much less frequent, more like once a year. If it's an automatic wireless transfer from the odometer, that may be more like quarterly. ODOT would have to structure the frequency depending on the amount and the cumbersome nature of the reporting. The bill does not state that specifically, but that's simply the reality of how ODOT would proceed.
Yeah. Rather than go into more detailed questions now, I'd like to get to the very general questions. We have one person who's come from more than 100 miles away. We have another who needs to leave pretty soon. So I'd like to hear a statement, if she wants to give it, from Representative Beyer. And then I have some questions about the scope of the bill, and then I'd like to get to these other witnesses.
Thank you, co-chairs and committee. Having been dealing with transportation issues
For the record,
I did this last time, too. So for the record, my name is Representative Terry Beyer. I represent House District 12, which is Springfield. And thank you for allowing me to come. And with that, transportation issues have been on my plate for a long time and have become extremely aware of the volatility of our funding systems, given technology going on out there, fuel efficiency, new vehicle models, felt like that at some point we had to start having the conversation about where we go from here. This one to me seemed like a good first step as we move. And while it is about the future of revenue for our system, in my mind, this really is about fairness to the system, and that we do actually, our citizens definitely value the cost responsibility model that we have in Oregon. And while this probably doesn't tip the balance one way or another right now, it will eventually affect that. And as he said, constitutionally, we really are required to pay our share. Feedback I've gotten on this bill, pretty much people agree that there is an issue of fairness and that we should all be paying our fair share of the road. I think the disagreements or, you know, the conversation has been more about what that fair share should be and collection models. I come into this valuing a true user fee, that we should be paying for how much we use the road. And if we choose to use a less fuel-efficient vehicle, then that counts too. You're paying more to drive that vehicle. So that is where I come from on this. And while people have talked about a flat fee, which would be a lot simpler to administer, it really doesn't address, for me, the issue of fairness, because we don't all use the road the same amount, and I think that should be reflected. And when it comes to the fee, I would say the committee put the number in there, the 0.006 number in the bill, out of concern about the new technology and being fair and not disincenting them. But it really is too low, and I felt at the time it was too low. And I know there's still some concern about what that number is. I think that it, you know, it deserves a fair look. I appreciate the committee wanting to look at that. But I would hate to see it go back down to the number, which to me does not reflect the cost of using our road system. So these are the tenets that I came to this discussion with, and seem to be, for the most part, what the Road User Task Force, of which I chaired, agreed on. And it was great to have this group working. And with that, I will go ahead and end my statement. And I know Maureen Bach is here. She was pointing to me the confidentiality and where it was addressed in the bill, so she could answer specifically to that.
And we may get to those later. Are there any questions now for Representative Beyer? Thank you. This panel, thank you very much. We're not finished with you by any stretch, but this is the public hearing. I wanted to make sure we get to the members of the public who are here today. Thank you. Let's hear from Paul Cosgrove, who has to leave soon, and then David, you'll be up after that, and then Barry. Please.
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. I need to start with an apology to the co-chairs of the Transportation Committee. Our industry has had a number of rather major issues in the building, and we're a little late. We should have made this presentation to you at your Transportation Committee. Let me tell you our basic concern, and it's a concern about the bill. It's not yet or may never be opposition. We would like to ask you to be part and parcel of developing a comprehensive and coordinated state policy with respect to alternative fuel vehicles. And let me give you the four state agencies with whom we think have issues and currently inconsistent policies about these vehicles. First, the Department of Energy, which has for years given tax credits under both Betsy and Retsy for alternative fuel vehicles, electric and all sorts of other alternatives. And, of course, as an industry, we're concerned to be technology neutral and hopefully drive a variety of new technologies, all of which have benefits, environmental and otherwise, for the public and our economy. So ODO. And those issues are before you or will be before you in the Tax Credit Committee. And at the point where we're trying to consider extending those to give a credit to people who do this, we're also imposing a fee on this side. So I think we need to think how those fit together. I'm not saying you can't do both, but I think we need to coordinate that. Mm-hmm. The second issue is economic development. We have a department, Business Oregon, who's given a great deal of money, both federal and state money, to develop infrastructure for these vehicles. So we're spending money there, and appropriately so, to help foster the use of these vehicles. Mm-hmm. The third one is the Department of Environmental Quality, and I'd just like to take you back to 2007. This body prohibited the Department of Environmental Quality from adopting rules to pattern our air emissions rules after California emission rules. That was with a Republican House and a Democratic Senate. It was line item vetoed by our governor. In fact, those rules were then adopted administratively, and they have a zero emission vehicle requirement in them that is not yet enforced, but will be shortly. So we have one state agency saying the manufacturers must provide zero-emission vehicles. We have to find ways to make sure people buy them because the federal government has average fuel economy requirements for us. We have another state agency helping to build the infrastructure, a third state agency giving credits to individuals and businesses who buy the cars, and now we have ODOT talking about a fee. We believe that the cost responsibility model is the right one. But, you know, we had a model, we had a pilot a couple, 5 years ago, and it wasn't restricted to electric cars or any other cars. This is an issue that's industry-wide, vehicle-wide. And the solution has to be vehicle-wide. We are not currently fair in a number of ways. A Prius owner isn't going to be subject to this fee and has mileage twice as much as a efficient import or domestic small car. That's not fair if they drive the same number of miles. So we believe that a policy that develops a system to replace or supplement the gas tax to make it fair, regardless of what kind of vehicle, regardless of what kind of fuel source, would be the way to go. I guess our concern is, well, we're trying to develop a niche market, and I need to point out that there are now less than 300 Chevy Volts, which is one of the plug-in hybrids, that have been sold in the United States as a whole as of February. So this is a very early market. As we're trying to encourage that and we're trying to deal with cost responsibility, maybe we should take a different market segment as our pilot. I offer my hometown, the city of Portland. Maybe we should take drivers in the city of Portland as the pilot, regardless of their vehicle, to implement this kind of a system where people then actually use the technologies that need to be developed to pay an appropriate share based on their use of the roads, regardless of their fuel source. And then finally, I'd just like to point out there are other fuel sources that are involved and other technologies other than electric. We have natural gas, for which we have sort of a funny additional separate tax collection system. We will have fuel cell cars. They'll be not here immediately, but you saw some of them out on the road a couple of weeks ago. So we need to get ahead of this, but my suggestion is it isn't really an electric car issue, and we would hope that you don't sort of make that building market the target of this new and somewhat complicated system. Pick some other target, like a geographic area. Let's get going. Let's get something that does this fairly across the board and across the vehicle fleet. So that's our concern. Happy to answer your
Thank
questions.
You indicated there were four agencies. I got three of them written down.
ODOT.
Of course, ODOT. That fourth one.
I apologize, Mr. Chair.
No, I'm being overly literal. Questions for Paul? Representative Berger.
Paul, not to be too argumentative.
Please.
Your argument that this is complicated and suggestion that you take the whole city of Portland and put them on weight mile or something, you're arguing against yourself there, sir, and I just had to point it out.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair, I said that somewhat facetiously. I did to make the point that really the issue of fairness and cost responsibility isn't a technology-specific issue. Mm-hmm. It is across the whole vehicle fleet, and we're going to continue to face it with new technologies. And we would think that maybe a broader test, like the pilot that was done in 2005-2006, which gave the initial information to come down this road, was not a technology-specific pilot. It was people volunteered. Some had high-mileage cars. Some probably had low-mileage cars.
We need to get to other people, and I could argue.
Thank you very much. Obviously, we'll continue this conversation. One quick point while you're on your moving to your next, because you have to leave here in 1 minute according to your schedule.
Thank you.
It appears to me, looking at this bill quickly, as though some of what you're, at least some of what you're asking about could be accommodated in the definition section, which would allow for the department to react in accordance with the development of the technology and development of standard communication standards and a variety of things of that sort. So I don't think that, I don't think this bill is necessarily premature, but it might require a few tweaks to make that happen. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Ogden Steers, Barry Woods. Good morning. Go
Good
ahead.
Morning. Good morning, all. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, my name is David Steers. No one my size would like to be called Steers. I'm a resident of Lincoln County, and for the past 2 years have been privileged to be an electric car driver. My retirement present to myself was a Tesla Roadster. No one I have heard here this morning has spoken from the experience of owning and operating an electric vehicle. I can answer any questions you may have about it, but let me tell you that we feel terribly responsible. I'm a member of both the Oregon Electric Vehicle Association and the Northwest Tesla Roadster Club. These are very smart, very committed people and have been for more years than I've been driving an electric car. Many of the OEVA members have actually built, fabricated their own electric vehicles for conventional day-to-day use or for racing purposes. They are blisteringly fast cars. Some years ago, before I started, before I took delivery of the vehicle, I approached Representative Cowan from Lincoln County and suggested an electric or alternative vehicle license plate for the state of Oregon, mostly because I think it's important that we begin to announce to other drivers that these cars aren't theoretical, they are on the road. They are quiet. They do not pollute. Oregon gets less than 4% of its energy from coal. The manufacture of electricity is, for the most part in our state, extremely clean. I confess that while I'm mostly mainstream and very respectful of other vehicles on the road, I turn into a bit of a smug bucket on Earth Day with reusable shopping bags and an electric car and try to get over it as quickly as possible, but it does linger. I'd like to make the car available, actually, to members of the committee on a mutually acceptable day. I would love to either give you a drive in it or ask you to drive it yourselves to understand precisely what most electric car owners already know. It is quick. It's quiet. It does not infringe on the earth in the ways that ICE vehicles do, internal combustion engines, do by design. The moment you turn them on, they begin to affect the environment. All of the members of OEVA and the Northwest Tesla Roadster Club are terribly conflicted, very concerned about the methodology of tax level and collection. To a person, they agree that road use should be paid for by vehicles. Remember that our footprint is less than any other vehicle on the road. We are lighter and absolutely non-polluting for both noise, which is very important to me, and for the environment. And we'll be watching very closely. I don't bring persuasions or arguments or any other insights, having read the bill only this morning. But you will be monitored by, this process will be monitored rightly by the most directly concerned people in the electric vehicle family. And I think part of the overriding concern is the perception that possible owners might be deterred. We want more electric vehicles on the road. We certainly want them paying for the use of the road, but for the good of the environment, for the rebalance of the oil economy, it's not entirely inconceivable that we could begin to shift the balance of electrical very fuel-efficient plug-in vehicles, and begin to lessen our dependence not on foreign oil, which I've always found a misleading comparison, reduce our dependence on foreign oil. We must, in my view, begin to reduce our dependence on oil, period. It invites a variety of negative things for me. That is precisely what I had to say. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mr. Woods.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Barry Woods, and my day job, I'm an attorney working in the clean energy, electric vehicle, and smart grid areas. Today I'm here before you representing Drive Oregon, which is a trade association of Oregon-based companies that are involved throughout the electric vehicle ecosystem, anywhere from wiring harness manufacturers to infrastructure. We have three infrastructure-based charging station manufacturers, as well as a variety of electric vehicle designers and prospective manufacturers, from Arcimoto in the Eugene area to Greenlight Motors to Brammo Motorcycles, which are down in the Ashland area. So I appreciate the opportunity, Co-Chair Barnard, Co-Chair Berger, to and the rest of the committee members to present our view on this. First of all, I think we'd be delighted to have the problem that there's no revenue from fuel tax and that you need to look at alternative sources for revenue within the transportation sector. I think the big question is how soon might that transformation occur? I also want to point out that I've had a couple of different conversations with Jim Witte. He's been very gracious with his time, and generally speaking, we don't have any, what I would view, significant issues with the bill's direction in terms of the need to be fair and the need to reflect the new revenue stream that electric vehicles need to provide in order to pay their share. The question that we have, I think, is more a question of balancing some of the needs of the industry at this early stage relative to the need for a more creative way to approach efficiency and some of the failings of the gas tax because of increased efficiency. As we proceed, I think my comments are probably more detailed, and I'd suggest that you refer to those. I'd like to hit maybe three main areas of the proposed Dash 8 amendment going forward. I think that the other thing is I think that the impact of this bill, quite personally, I think there's a greater impact with tax credits than there probably would be with respect to having a road use fee attached to electric vehicles.
Colleagues, he's referring to the A version of the bill. When he said,
I'm sorry, A version. The
yeah,
A version.
Please, go ahead.
Yes. So I think that the impact of this in terms of operational cost is probably relatively minor, but the interesting thing is that the way this bill has been presented has elicited a tremendous stream of dialogue on the listservs that I'm aware of here in Oregon, primarily concerned about focusing on EVs at a time where their early adoption, there's still a lot of questions about forecasting and exactly how consumer-friendly these products are going to be. And so there's some perception, and maybe perception is reality, that a road usage tax that's focused on EVs could be very detrimental to the way the public perceives their cost and so forth. I think there's some evidence out there, for example, that, again, in terms of what are the impacts on consumer behavior, I think there's evidence out there that says that the size of the federal tax credit actually has greater impact than something like this, or range anxiety, or the availability of infrastructure. Those are kind of the three primary concerns that have been focused on in terms of consumer adoption of electric vehicles. So while the impact of this may, in a financial sense, be modest, and we're not going to argue about the need to pay a just and equitable share, I think that there is some very serious concerns about from the EV community as well as from the industry that this is focusing on EVs to the exclusion of other types of transportation. And I know from conversations with Jim Witte that in a lot of ways this is intended to begin the process of revising how revenue is collected in the transportation sector and ultimately may affect combustion engines. And I would urge you to be considerate of that as part of the intent of the bill, whether in the language or in the context of the bill, to help displace some of the concern that it's focusing on EVs. But just to kind of go through some of the language and the sections that we had that we would like to see some additional consideration. And again, I don't know what the number is. I'm not here to argue one number over another in terms of what the rate may be. But I think that there are some general concepts that ought to be factored in as you guys consider how best to word this. Under Section 2, for example, subsection 3B, which is discussing the opt-in provision for some combustion engines that has a 5,000 vehicle cap, I think one of the concerns that struck me, and this is probably relatively minor, but that there may be a loophole there that would allow, for example, a Cadillac Escalade to opt in and take advantage of a rate that would certainly be much more beneficial to them than the existing fuel tax. And that's irrespective of whether you keep the rate at 1.43 or make some other determinations. And so I would urge the committee to look at that to see if there might be a way to allow the opt-in benefit to go to a higher mileage combustion vehicle, maybe the CAFE standard that Jim suggested at 36 or maybe something above that, but something that would provide the benefit to a higher mileage combustion vehicle as opposed to just kind of throwing the gates open to whomever gets in before the cap is filled. The more significant sections that I'd like to talk about for a moment would be the Section 2, Subsection 4, which is the actual charge per mile rate that currently is placed in the bill. The attachment B that I gave you has got some suggested language that addresses my remarks in terms of the proposed amendments, but it's not intended to be definitive by any means, but just to provide some sample thoughts on how you might approach this. So the 0.6 cents per mile, based on my understanding from talking to Mr. Witte, was originally proposed by ODOT and is intended to track with a very high-efficiency combustion engine on the order of a Prius, on the order of a 50-mile-per-gallon equivalent. So a very efficient combustion engine. The 1.43 number that's currently in play is intended to track with what the average Oregonian pays under the existing fuel tax, which is approximately calculated at a 21-mile-per-gallon rate. The concerns that we have are that during the initial part of this, it would be preferable to not have electric vehicles hit at what would be considered an average mileage rate, at least initially. And so we would like to have the committee reconsider going back to the 0.6 cent mile for a period of time. And this is going to be obviously subject to some debate as to what might be an appropriate trigger. And the trigger reflects the maturity of the market. And the trigger may be, and I've chosen 1% as market penetration, 1% of sales, annual sales as market penetration. And in part, that's something that I think we all understand from our experience with the Prius, which just recently got to the 1.3% mark after 10 years. So the 1% trigger, market penetration trigger, may be a reasonable way to reflect adequate maturity, within this sector of the acceptability of the technology, of the availability of the infrastructure. I would defer to economists on the in support of this committee to refine that. But I think the issue that we're concerned with is allowing, instead of a temporal number such as 2014, which may or may not reflect much in terms of the market development. For example, Pike Research in March came up with a number for Oregon that projected only 7,600 electric vehicles were going to be sold by 2017. I think that's probably extremely conservative, but if you look at other sophisticated forecasters in this area, PGE. I mean, they don't know. I mean, it could be 1%, it could be 5% by 2020. There's a lot of uncertainty. So the idea of having a market penetration trigger, I think, is of benefit both in terms of allowing the market to evolve naturally, and also if it's sooner, then the revenue stream will increase that much more quickly. So rather than choosing a prophesying that 2014 is the right time, where none of us really has a clear indication of how this is going to unfold, I think the market penetration trigger is something that ought to be considered seriously.
Thank you. And did you have some other points? Because we're rapidly running out of time.
Sorry. The last point, one other quick point on the rate per mile. Oregon has a number of manufacturers, Arcimoto, Greenlight, that have what I would consider non-traditional electric vehicle type designs that are low weight. So one additional thought, and I know this is already being viewed as a somewhat complex accounting system, but I'm not sure in the end that it is. But one thought is to allow for a 2,000-pound exemption to reflect the less wear on roads based on that weight. And I think there's not a lot of data that ODOT has presented to distinguish between a 10,000-pound vehicle or a 2,000-pound vehicle. But certainly common sense suggests there's less wear and tear. But it also would have an added benefit of economically of promoting Oregon-based manufacturers whose vehicles also fit within that exemption. So I would ask that you consider looking at an exemption, not dismissing a charge, but again, gradually increasing it based on penetration rate. Lastly, on the reporting requirement, I understand from Jim Witte that there's probably little impetus to have a monthly reporting. I think that there is discretion reserved for that. I think we have concerns, obviously, from the consumer standpoint, and it's maybe more of a perception than an actual concern, but it's important that the reporting requirement be a more modest, maybe an annual, maybe a quarterly, but at least to be conscious of the need to not require as frequent reporting as might otherwise be suggested. And I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Berger.
Thank you. Mr. Stiers, sincere apologies. It's my fault that your name was Mr. Another couple of other quick points. One, I am quite frankly surprised there aren't more electric vehicle owners in this room. You spoke eloquently on their behalf. And I appreciate that we want to hear from them because it's a small subset, but they are directly impacted. And I would also commend you as an Oregon resident to pay attention to this committee because we will be dealing with tax credits for electric vehicles in a more generic sense and film and video tax credits.
Good.
So I admire your work, and I'm glad to meet you and see you here.
I'm grateful.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your coming today and your patience while we went through all of our other business very much. And we're finished for today. Do I have anything to carry over today?
Do we have more people?
Do we have more people? Is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill who could come tomorrow if we carried it over? There's at least one. So two. So we will carry, if that all right?
Yeah.
We carry this over on this bill over for public hearing until tomorrow. House Bill 2328. We'll close the public hearing now. Paul, anything else I need to announce? All right. With that, committee's adjourned. Thank you very much.